It's got to start with knowing the enemy, right? Everything always starts with knowing the adversary. And it becomes particularly important as we think about conflict, maybe potentially over the next 10 years. We frankly needed at that time to shift away from looking at a broad OE to really capture where the Army was going, which was to be a threat-based Army. I think no matter where you are within the Department of Defense, you know, what we say in this document will at least be of interest to you, if not essentially important to you.
This is The Convergence, the Army's Mad Scientist podcast. I'm Rachel Melling of the Mad Scientist team, and I'll be joined in just a moment by Matt Sanisbert, Deputy Director of Mad Scientist. Mad Scientist is a U.S. Army initiative that continually explores the evolution of warfare, challenges assumptions, and collaborates with academia, industry, and government. You can follow us on social media at Army Mad Sci or subscribe to the blog, the Mad Scientist Laboratory at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Today we're talking with Mr. Ian Sullivan, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Intelligence, G2, at the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command. Mr. Sullivan is going to talk with us today about the TRADOC G2's newly released foundational document, The Operational Environment 2024 to 2034, Large-Scale Combat Operations. Let's get started.
Sir, this is your sixth appearance on the show, but this is your first appearance as a solo guest. So welcome just today, Mr. Ian Sullivan.
Well, thanks, Matt. Thank you, Rachel. It's fun. I guess I needed five other tries to get the mic by myself. So looking forward to this.
Sixth time is the charm.
Yeah, something like that.
So we're going to talk today about our OE document, the Operational Environment 2024 to 2034, Large-Scale Combat Operations. This is a seminal document for the TRADOC G2. So what was the reason for writing and publishing this document now, at this point in time?
Yeah, so the reason it's being published now is that, frankly, it's time. We write an OE assessment every couple of years. I've been here since 2017. We did the first one in, I guess it was 2018, as a non-doctrinal piece, and then we released it as a TRADOC PAM in 2019. During the pandemic, we released our second OE assessment, the OE in Competition, Crisis, and Conflict, and that was in 2021. We frankly needed at that time to shift away from looking at a broad OE that was really focused on factors within the OE, like technology and demographics and really the environmental issues of the OE, to really capture where the Army was going, which was to be a threat-based Army. And we also had to discuss the pandemic, which was very real and very ongoing at that particular moment. That one never became doctrinal, mostly because it was just too hard to get things done during the pandemic. But that was a very important document, and it started our shift to really looking at the threat. Well, now here we are a couple years later, and the world is similar but quite different. A lot of what we said in the previous OE holds. We're still looking at the same threats, but each of these threats are now involved in a very real issues around the globe. You know, we've had a return to large-scale combat operations. We have the largest conflict going on in Europe right now since the Second World War. And frankly, that alone is enough to really call for a new document. But really, this is also about the needs of the Army. As the Army starts looking at large-scale combat operations, and I shouldn't say start, I really should say continues looking at large-scale combat operations, because this has been now going on for several years. But what we've had really since the last OE document was released has been sort of a schoolhouse in looking at LSCO from the adversary's perspective. We've had a number of opportunities to see conflicts around the globe, to learn from them, to observe them, and to really see what our adversaries were thinking and frankly doing. And so the time was definitely ripe to produce this new document, and I couldn't be happier about it. It I think hits everything that we really need to do in terms of showing how the adversary has adapted towards LSCO.
Sir, you just mentioned that we published our first OE in 2018 and then the TRADOC PAM in 2019. So that OE was called the Operational Environment and the Changing Character of Warfare. And I wanted to do a little bit of a comparison between that document and this new OE. So how does this version of the OE differ from the previous publication?
Yeah, I mean, so first, I talked about it a little bit before. Part of it is in the scope of what it covers. So that OE assessment that the team put together back in 2018 and 2019 really looked at, for lack of a better term, the environmental factors of the OE. It was focusing on technology, focused heavily on technology. It focused on demographics. It focused on some of the political military realities that we were seeing. And then when it did delve down into looking at warfare, it was very capabilities-based. It was not looking at the threat. And so it did that one did a pretty good job in some ways of I think, foreshadowing where we are now. When it talked about things like hiders versus finders, and when it talked about sort of strikers versus protectors, when it hinted at the transparent battle space, I think it did a pretty good job, but it was really based on capabilities because the Army hadn't, or the Joint Force, hadn't really completed its change to a threat-based force. This document takes what we laid, I think, in that earlier draft and takes it to the next level because it looks at combat and it looks specifically at combat. In fact, it looks specifically at LSCO, large-scale combat operations, which is one form of warfare that the Army could find itself involved in and potentially the near future, I suppose. But it looks at it through the lens of the adversaries. It looks at it through what they're learning and what they're doing on these various battle spaces. And frankly, we've had a couple to look at, right? Some of them not necessarily adversarial. We learned a lot, say, from the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and that's captured in this, some of that's captured in this document. Learned an awful lot from Russia-Ukraine, right, as we've been observing that conflict literally from its inception back in February of 2022. This document sort of takes all of that and then puts it in the lens of LSCO and essentially makes it just that required document for the Army as it thinks about LSCO. And it should serve as the center point for what we do in terms of integrating what we know about the threat, how the threat envisions LSCO, into the Army's leadership development, training, and education system, which certainly TRADOC runs through the schools and centers, into doctrine, and then hopefully with our, again, with our partners at Army Futures Command across DOTMIL PFP as we seek to integrate each of those into everything that the Army needs to do.
So we can kind of see the evolution of Army thinking when we look back at Changing Character of Warfare to the 2021 document to this one now. And as you said, it's focused on LSCO. But we acknowledge that LSCO is not the only possible type of conflict we could get into. So why did we choose to focus this one on LSCO specifically?
I think for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think because it's certainly the high end of what we need to worry about. And I think also because, frankly, our adversaries are preparing for it. When you look at Russia, they're engaged in what certainly passes for LSCO right now in Ukraine. You know, their own construct actually has four different types of conflict. And I think they'd be in the third level, which is somewhere between regional conflict and LSCO. But this is LSCO, right? The Chinese People's Liberation Army is certainly preparing for LSCO. When you look at what they're training, when you look at their modernization, when you look at what they're doing across the board to improve their force, when you see what they're doing off Taiwan, you know, in terms of pressuring the Taiwanese, when you see them flexing their might regionally, they're thinking about LSCO. And so from our perspective, this is the gold standard that the Army needs to be ready for. It truly needs to be ready for LSCO against one of those adversaries. And frankly, that's what we're trying to educate and get the force ready for. That doesn't mean we've forgotten lessons from things like counterinsurgency. In fact, when you think about LSCO in these broad senses, it certainly would incorporate elements from counterinsurgency. You know, there's certainly other types of operations, right? There's humanitarian operations, which we could clearly be involved in, peace enforcement, peace stability, you know, certainly sort of some of the missions the Army could be asked to perform in the near future. But LISCO's the tough one, particularly against a peer adversary. And frankly, it's something we haven't had to truly concern ourselves with for some time. So I think the focus on LISCO is certainly merited, particularly within the window that we work within in Training and Doctrine Command.
With this focus on LISCO, the way that the OE is set up is it explores 12 conditions of LISCO and then 5 resulting implications. So what was the process for establishing the 12 conditions and the 5 implications? How did we really come to that conclusion and why did we set it up that way?
Yeah, so this is actually, I think, the coolest part of, frankly, of this document and of the work that was done here. It was set up that way because it came up that way from the bottom up. And so what might not be known when you read this document is just the sheer amount of work that truly went into it. When the Russia-Ukraine war began in February of 2022, the team here within the TRADOC G2, the analytic team within its analytic control element, its ACE, really on the fly completely changed the way it did its work. And it started filling a vacuum that existed within the Army, which was observing what was going on that battle space, looking at it from the red perspective. So particularly focusing on Russian activities in Ukraine. What is it that we could learn about the Russians, who are one of the key threats that we face according to the National Defense Strategy? And then it allowed us to take those observations and say, all right, well, what did we get right about the Russians? What did we get wrong about the Russians in our analysis before that? So that was kind of interesting. It then morphed into supporting the Center for Army Lessons Learned, where we would provide red insights so that they could make broader insights for about what was going on with the Army. So what did it all mean for the Army? And that became a really, I think, important symbiotic relationship. You know, the observations of red driving what blue needed to do about it. So that was sort of the start of the process. Well, what that morphed into was essentially a weekly look at this conflict, where we would have all of our analysts come together and make insights. And we've created a database. There are thousands of entries at this point over a several-year period of what we saw that was interesting on that battle space. What were the Russians doing? Now that changed a little bit. Some of it looked at what the Ukrainians were doing. Some of it hit some sort of international aspects of the conflict, but the core of that was looking at the adversary. Well, as we move forward and as we sort of got more comfortable with that, we realized that it was an important mechanism for the entire analytic structure within the G2, right? It became a key business practice. And as we created a more detailed program of analysis, looking at the questions that we needed to answer, which incidentally also came from the bottom up, polling the analysts and figuring out what needed to be done, we adapted that process. And so we started looking at 10 questions within our program of analysis, looking at all of the threats that the National Defense Strategy points out, pacing threat, acute threat, regional threats, and then the VEOs. And we're doing the same thing, making these observations and keeping the database and making sure they're the best information available, bouncing what we're learning on the unclassified side against what we know from the classified sources that we routinely look at, to come up with sort of the best story about what the adversary is doing and thinking. And so all of that came together as we wrote this document. And all 12 of these conditions really derived from that work, those observations, and then sort of taking them all and putting them together, getting the analyst again at the grassroots level to say what are important, what's not important. You know, you might have had 10 people say that UAVs were important in LISCO from what they're seeing in Russia, Ukraine, and elsewhere, but it was a matter of just taking those 10 and saying, okay, that's really one condition, right? But that's sort of what happened, and so it was looking through that just significant and from my perspective, truly amazing amount of work that the analytic team within the G2 did over those years since the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and then expanding it broader to include the other threats to figure out what we think drives LISCO, what we think we're seeing in LISCO, And then having that same team look at it and say, okay, what's it mean for the Army? I'm kind of notorious within the G2, you know, for asking about the what, the so what, and the so what of the so what. You know, when we get to the deeper implications, we're getting to the so what and the so what of the so what. And I think that's critically important for any document that is rooted in intelligence.
Are you able to give us, or give the audience really, any more detail on maybe a couple of the implications or some of the conditions that we have in there?
There are 12 conditions, right? And there are 5 implications. I'll actually run through all of them because I think it's important to talk about them. And we won't go in grave detail, right? Go download it and read it. But essentially, the 12 conditions that contribute to LSCO, the first is all-domain competition warfare. And that's the notion that the adversaries that we face, from the pacing threat to the acute threat to the regional threats, and frankly, even the VEOs, right? Anyone who watched what happened in Israel in October of last year could see sort of a poor man's vision of all-domain warfare. The adversaries that face us are going to challenge us across domains, and frankly, they're going to integrate across domains to challenge us, and that's something that we're going to need to prepare for. The notions of mass versus precision, that's been, I think, a real factor as we look at Russia-Ukraine. This notion that it's great to be precise and to be able to hit the exact targets that you'd like to, but there's a notion that, you know what, sometimes mass matters too, particularly in LSCO, the notion of essentially massing and essentially using combat power as a giant fist when you need it. LSCO will see both and will require both. I mentioned UAVs. There's no need to go in detail on this, but UAVs are changing the face of battle. They're becoming such an omnipresent part of the battle space. And frankly, LSCO is going to see an increased use of these systems, I think, in the near future. We've seen them dominate the battle spaces in Nagorno-Karabakh, and we've seen them have a massive impact in Russia-Ukraine. Magazine depth and range, critically important, right? We already talked about mass and precision, and this kind of goes with it. Magazine depth is problematic because of the sheer expenditure rates of these weapon systems. You know, I think the estimates that everybody made over how many rounds would be fired and on a given day really were turned on their head as we started seeing what was happening in Russia and Ukraine, when the Russians were firing 20, 30, or sometimes even 40,000 rounds of artillery a day. You know, and again, this is coming from a force in the U.S. Army during COIN where you might fire 10 rounds a week, right? And so this was a wake-up call. And then you look at what the Chinese are thinking. One of their enduring lessons is, geez, I wonder why the Russians are firing so little, right? So when you think 40,000 is little, that tells you what the Chinese are thinking. So magazine depth matters. And then when you add range to that, what you're talking about is an ability to strike deeper and deeper and deeper. The Russia-Ukraine war shows that both sides' homelands are vulnerable. It shows that you can just strike at increasing ranges. When you start thinking about the pacing threat in the Indo-Pacific, you're talking about strikes out to the second island chain and beyond, right? The range just becomes longer and longer in which adversaries can engage themselves. The next one is a transparent battle space. It's really hard to hide. Sensors are everywhere, from the sublime to the ridiculous, right? Some of the most sophisticated sensors on the planet, be they overhead, be they ground-based, be they aerial-based, or maybe even the best system, which we've often said is the Ukrainian teenager and his cell phone. But all of that comes together to make it really hard to hide, really hard to mask your movements, really hard to mask your presence. And it goes back to something that was said in the Starry report all those years ago in 1973. If you can be seen, you can be struck, and if you can be struck, you can be killed. And the transparent battle space makes that happen really across time and space in a way that we haven't seen before. Increased lethality, well, that's kind of a no-brainer. When you put all of these factors together, the range in which you can be engaged, the fact that you can be seen everywhere, the precision weapons versus massed weapons, unmanned systems, the sheer effectiveness of things like anti-tank guided missiles, increasingly effective explosives, combat's lethal, and LSCO is the most lethal of all combat. Anti-access area denial, A2AD. Again, just the ability to command battle spaces at range and prevent an adversary from arriving, something that we will certainly have to face globally. Dense urban warfare, you know, we saw that in COIN in places like Iraq, Syria. You know, another life was involved in some things in Mosul. You know, we saw urban fighting matter. Well, geez, in Russia, Ukraine, it's happened in spades when you've looked at some of the fighting for these cities, reminiscent of what we saw in the Second World War in places like Stalingrad or Berlin or Aachen or even Manila. So dense urban warfare is back. And incidentally, you see it in some cases slightly less than LISCO. For example, if you look at what's going on in Gaza between the Israel Defense Force and Hamas. Homeland defense, I mentioned that before, because of the range of weapon systems, because of the non-kinetic effects that can be used, the homeland is at risk. We've seen that in every conflict that we've observed, and it's going to be part and parcel of every conflict going forward. Homelands are no longer a sanctuary, and that likely includes the United States. Contested logistics. Logistics is what feeds combat, and if you can cut off that supply, the adversary's got problems. Well, in Russia and Ukraine, both sides have tried to work on each other's logistics systems. Logistics is hard on the best of days, and in LISCO, it's even harder because of, again, everything that we've talked about before in terms of transparent battle space and the sheer amount of fires that can be sort of thrown around a battle space. Weapons of mass destruction. Now, we haven't seen them used in any kind of dramatic way in any of these battle spaces, but they've certainly been brought to mind. You know, the Russians will periodically remind the world that they're a nuclear-armed power, flex their nuclear saber. They've done that a number of times during the battle space. And we have, frankly, seen some limited use of chemical weapons on battle spaces, really going back to places like Iraq and Syria, but even in Russia and Ukraine, particularly irritants. Information advantage is the last one we'll talk about, and again, sort of something that we've been looking at for a long time. Information is critical. All sides are going to work for it. Setting the narrative matters. Being able to have an impact on the outside world matters. Being able to have an impact on your adversary matters. We've seen the Russians and the Ukrainians both engage in an information fight war to the hilt, and it's just becoming increasingly critical across really all of warfare. The Chinese, for example, believe that information advantage is a prerequisite for all military operations, so they won't go to war unless they think they have it, right? So those are the 12 conditions. So what are the implications? We have five of those. The first is one that I've sort of bashed around for a while, and I think the team was kind enough to add it to this. It's this notion of the art versus science of war. Really, I think as we look at LISCO and as we look at what everything put together means for the battle space, it's really fascinating that many of our adversaries look at warfare differently than we do. And that gets into that art versus science of war. I'll use the example of the U.S. and the Chinese, for example. Of course, Sun Tzu wrote The Art of War, right? But the Chinese today aren't really about the art of war. They're about the science of war. They believe that warfare is a mathematical problem and that every question raised within it has a mathematical answer. That's a very science-heavy view of warfare. The United States is really on the other side. And even though we love things like technology, AI, right, and all of this come together, at the end of the day, the U.S. Joint Force and many of our allies and partners really believe in the strength of our people and making the right decision really at that gut level. And so while technology and AI and everything's going to help that along the way, we believe in our people and believe that that's what gives us the edge in a battle space. And so moving forward, it will be fascinating to see how these two viewpoints actually operationalize. Hopefully we never find out in practice, but they're definitely two different approaches. The next implication all this brings together, this unique, I suppose, symbiotic relationship between maneuver, fires, and protection. I'll actually quote the Combined Arms Center commander, Lieutenant General Beagle, who actually laid it out really nicely in a session where I was, and I hope I'm doing it right and doing it justice. But We used to say that, you know, you would have to essentially maneuver to set up fires. Well, now you have to protect to do all of it, right? So you have to protect in order to maneuver and maneuver. It's just, there's this symbiotic relationship between the three, and protection in all forms is going to become more critical. I mentioned people are the advantage. In many cases, it's the side with the people who are the most dynamic, who are prevailing on the battle space. You know, when you look at the Russia-Ukraine conflict, I think the people matter greatly for whatever reason. The Russians have had edges in materiel, numbers, sheer size of their nation, their defense budget, all of that. But the Ukrainian will to fight, which is really enshrined in their people, has essentially kept this conflict going really for those many years now. Rapid adaptation. We're seeing sides make changes on the fly in ways we've never seen before. You see a side come up with a cool idea for a drone, and they try it, and it works for a week, and then the other side reacts, and it doesn't work. And so then they make a new adaptation, and this cycle has gone on and on and on in the Russia-Ukraine war, and it's happening at a lightning pace. It really shows the need to allow for that adaptation and to foster sort of a culture of adaptation, because the side that does it best is going to have an advantage. You know, multi-domain operations calls for windows of opportunity, and it's this kind of rapid adaptation that might get you a window. And then lastly, the notion of wars of annihilation versus wars of attrition. This is a tough one for us to think about, but it really comes down to a short war versus a long war. You could make an argument that the U.S. Joint Force was designed to win wars of annihilation, right? Really short, sharp conflicts, similar to Desert Storm. The Russians probably believed Ukraine was going to be a war of annihilation, and guess what? It was not. It's become a war of attrition. And it seems like wars of attrition become sort of the historical norm when great powers clash. It's very rare for a conflict between great powers to be decided rapidly. It's happened, but it hasn't happened that often. And so when you think about conflicts with some of these threats who are peers, the PLA, potentially Russia in some cases, you know, we need to think about what a war of attrition would mean, because it's a whole different animal than a war of annihilation. So I kind of hit all of them. But please read the document, because the document will explain it much better than I just did.
There's a line in the foreword of this document, and it's from General Brito, the TRADOC CG, and I can't remember the exact wording of it. Essentially, it talks about, in order to be successful, we need to know the enemy.
I have it right here. To achieve victory, we must know the enemy, and that starts with knowing the operational environment.
Exactly. And I think that is such an important message for our soldiers, our civilians, our contractors, really everybody that's involved. And so I wanted to ask you who you see as the audience for this document, and what should they be learning from it?
Yeah, so I think the audience for this document, the primary audience is the main TRADOC audience that we focus on in the schools and the centers, right? Where we're teaching about warfare, where we're teaching the Army business, it's got to start with knowing the enemy. Right? Everything always starts with knowing the adversary. And it becomes particularly important as we think about conflict in the maybe potentially over the next 10 years. Because again, we're in the middle of a modernization effort. Some of it is coming fast and furious, but it's not all going to be done, you know, immediately. So it's going to take some time. So knowing the enemy and being prepared for the enemy really gives us a leg up. And we really get that through the centers and schools. But the audience is broader than that, right? Doctrine, I talked about it early. This OE should support doctrine. And frankly, it does, because we're already joined at the hip with the team out at CAC, the Combined Arms Center, that writes doctrine. And we set the OE tone. Well, this OE will make it even easier, because a lot of the doctrine that's being written right now focuses on LISCO. So when they think of RED and what RED is doing, right, we're going to lay it out for them right here. But I think the audience, again, is even broader than that, right? That's just the TRADOC audience. I think this document will have resonance across the Army. It will have resonance in the theaters, and we work closely with our friends out at USERPAC and out at USERAF and others, right? I think it will be useful for anybody who's contemplating large-scale combat operations. I think this document will be of interest to the joint force because we'll never fight alone. We're always going to fight as part of a joint force, which means it's also going to be relevant to our allies and partners because we're never going to fight as a single nation. We're going to fight with our allies and partners. The fact that we have such great allies and partners is really one of our enduring strengths. And so hopefully this document will be of interest to them as well. So I think this document has really broad impact, and I think no matter where you are within the Department of Defense, you know, what we say in this document will at least be of interest to you, if not essentially important to you.
I think showing how broad our intended audience is for it shows kind of how significant this document is and how much work went into it. So knowing what the audience is that you just described, is there one kind of a takeaway to make sure that our audience, you know, this is the one thing they have to come away with?
From the document itself, I think it comes down to understanding that when you look at LSCO and when you look at what our adversary is doing, and then when you think about the implications that we bring up, it shows us how serious it is to understand it and to understand how different it is. You know, I've often said that LSCO is kind of like an inferno, right? Because it just burns wide over the battle space on many levels. And you can kind of see that when you read this document. And so I think the takeaway is understanding that LSCO is gonna bring with it an inherent set of problems, and we need to think about them and understand them if we're gonna ever be forced to take them on. And the more work we do understanding them to the left of the conflict, the better we'll be if the balloon ever goes up in that regard.
I think it's great to give our listeners an idea of not only what's in the document, but kind of how we came to those conclusions and what our thinking was going through it. So, sir, since this is the first time you've been on as a solo guest, I don't think we ever went through the rapid-fire questions with you. I think Luke and I may have asked you them one time, but ended up not including them in one of the compilations. So this is our first official time to run through our rapid-fire questions with you, if you're ready.
All right, bring it on.
Okay. Number one, what's a threat or trend that keeps you up at night?
The thing that keeps me up at night is, frankly, watching the Chinese military modernization effort. You know, because I war game it so much, just understanding what it could mean if it goes right. The notion that an adversary is working like hell to build a force, a total force, right, across what we would call .milPF, designed to take us on and prevail with a unique approach to warfare really disturbs me on many levels and is probably the reason my hair is grayer today than it was a couple of years ago. But hopefully documents like this and learning from it makes it all the better. So I'll suffer the gray hair if we get this right.
All right. Number two, what's something about you that most people might not know?
Oh, geez. I don't know. I've been here so long, it seems like I'm an open book. But seeing how I'm talking, I'll throw this one out here. So many might not know this, but when I was a kid, I had to go to speech therapy classes for many, many years. It was very difficult for me to put words together. I actually spoke with something of a lisp, and I couldn't make certain sounds, and so it became very difficult for me to speak. So kind of funny because I seem to make my living talking a lot at this point. So I guess that's something out there, and thanks to a number of professionals over the years, I've at least partially overcome it. But you can tell sometimes if I'm tired, I will actually like mess up sounds.
Well, it obviously worked because whenever I do any of these events or talking appearances with you, I always tell everybody, it's going to be fine. All I have to do is let Mr. Sullivan talk.
Yeah, I always liked to communicate. It was the process of it was hard for many years. So hopefully I've overcome it.
All right, the final question. What's your favorite movie?
Now, how do you possibly answer that mm-hmm. question, right? Mm-hmm. What's your favorite mm-hmm. movie? Because again, you have to go by categories and all that, right? So I don't know how to truly answer it because I could, you know, go many ways, but I'll say this, right? So, I guess one of the movies that's always intrigued me the most, I saw it as a kid and it sort of developed a love, for like Victorian British military operations. as a kid, I saw the movie Zulu Dawn, right? 1979, it was made. Peter O'Toole and Burt Lancaster. It was a movie that always just sort of spurred my imagination. You know, I've seen it a million times. I collect toy soldiers, and so, like, I have the Zulu War set up in my living room. Not the Battle of Isandlwana, which the movie is about, but actually Rorke's Drift, which is the movie Zulu, if you ever choose to watch both of them. And all the way to the point where my wife got me for Christmas a couple years ago a British Martini Henry rifle from 1879, which was standard issue for the British forces at that time. So that's sort of like my favorite, like real, like serious favorite movie. But, you know, if you go into my office, I do have Lighten Up Francis hanging up and John Winger and Russell Ziske bobbleheads. So even though I shouldn't say it as an Army senior, I do find Stripes hysterical.
So would you say that it's kind of a chicken or egg thing? Was your love of the military and, you know, where you are now, was that because of the movies or were the movies because you were into the military?
I don't know. I think as a kid, I always just gravitated towards stories about, you know, like military history, and I always read about it and things like that. So I think it just all sort of hung together.
I'd say it worked out too.
Yeah, maybe.
So Mr. Ian Sullivan talking to us about our latest OE document, the Operational Environment 2024-2034 Large Scale Combat Operations, giving us a little bit of a preview of what this document is all about. Please go and check it out, download it, read it, share it. It's on the Mad Scientist Laboratory. There'll be links to it from there. Mr. Sullivan, thank you so much for coming and talking to us today and giving us a preview of this document.
Thanks. And congratulations to Mad Scientist. I guess this will be the 500th blog post.
That's correct.
We've already hit the 100th convergence. Yeah. So again, I guess I'm not 101, am I?
You're going to be 101.
I'll be 101. Yes. All right, there you go.
Yes. Shout out to Mr. Ian Kersey for all his great work on the Mad Scientist Laboratory.
Absolutely.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
Thanks for listening to The Convergence. I'd like to thank our guest, Mr. Ian Sullivan. You can follow us on social media at Army Mad Sci, and don't forget to subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider giving us a rating or review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you accessed it. This feedback helps us improve future episodes of The Convergence and allows us to reach a bigger and broader audience.